The place to focus your attention on this Transfiguration Sunday is on the eyes of the disciples. Heavy with fatigue, Luke says they were weighed down by sleep. No wonder. Those eyes had seen so much since the day they put down their nets for good. Peter, James, and John. They had seen miracles of multiplying bread and diseases healed and even restored life. They had watched with wonder as Jesus calmed a storm. And their eyes had surveyed the crowds that grew each day as Jesus taught and spoke parables. With fear and apprehension, their eyes had watched the religious authorities and the political establishment grow increasingly concerned about the impact of this Jewish Galilean rabbi. It had been a whirlwind journey since that day at the lake. They had come to the mountain. They had come to the mountain to get away from it all for just a little while. Can't you imagine the relief that flooded their eyes when Jesus suggested not that they move on to the next town, but that they climb the mountain for a time of prayer? These three disciples were Jesus' closest friends. They were the same ones who would pray with Him later in the garden of Gethsemane, where perhaps they would not be able to keep awake quite as well as they did on the mountain. But at this point, these three friends jump at the opportunity to go for a hike, to climb up the mountain and rest their weary eyes, to escape the crowds of needy people that pressed in on them, to unwind on a kind of a mountain retreat. Maybe they had in the back of their minds the ominous words that Jesus had spoken just before they left town. The Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and on the third day be raised. I imagine they were glad to have some time to sort out these troubling forecasts, but mostly, I imagine they needed a nap. But before they can even catch their breath, the disciples are bombarded, their senses overwhelmed by a fury of visions. Jesus transformed right before their eyes, His face shining like the sun, His clothes dazzling white. What happens next is even more surreal. Two heroes of the Jewish faith, Elijah the great prophet and Moses the giver of the law, appear out of thin air and begin to converse with Jesus. It is at this point in the story that I imagine the eyes of the disciples at their widest. And it is at this point in the story that the gospel writer Luke calls our attention away from Moses, Elijah, and Jesus and back to the fishermen. Since they had stayed awake, he writes, they saw His glory. This momentary vision of God's glory is a gift. But it is only a gift given to those whose eyes are open. Now, had the disciples consulted their Bibles before beginning the mountain climb, they may not have been so surprised by this sacred encounter or by the guests who joined Jesus. Maybe later the disciples did pull out their Torahs and remembered the role of the mountain in their faith stories. The shining face of Moses after his encounter with God on Sinai, or Elijah on top of Mount Horeb as God passed by in the sound of sheer silence, the still small voice. Those and many more mountaintop experiences of the people of God must have come to mind. This is the place where you meet God, on the mountaintop. I think this is where Peter, always the most resourceful of the disciples, gets his brilliant idea. Intent on remaining in this dream-like world, where the glory of God is so palpable everywhere around you, Peter switches from fisherman to tent maker. He plans to set up camp for a while. Now, Luke says that Peter did not know what he was saying. I'm not so sure I agree with Luke on that one. I think Peter knew exactly what he wanted when he asked to make three dwelling places for each of these three holy men. Have you ever wanted to put down roots in some sacred, safe place and just stay a while? It's the feeling of the kindergartner hanging on to her mother's pant leg on the first day of school. It's that emotional outpouring of a group of young people on the last morning of a meaningful retreat. They don't want to get back in the church van. It is the long hug in the airport drop-off area after a short visit that may be the last visit. I think it's why people linger for so long at the receptions that follow funerals. Safe, sacred space, surrounded by those who love and support you. Peter wanted to make it permanent. He wanted to live in this moment of glorious divine encounter. He had felt and seen what the poet John Donne begged for: batter my heart, three-personed God. For you as yet but knock and breathe and shine and tend to mend. Batter my heart. Peter knew that heart-battering feeling. And he wanted to stay right there, sacred, safe, mountaintop real estate. But Jesus is on the move, always, forever, frustratingly on the move. In the summer of 2003, I made a pilgrimage to Managua, Nicaragua, with a group of 12 college students. We were there to visit the Jubilee House community, founded by five Presbyterians who moved to Managua in 1994 with a vision for partnering with community leaders to enable economic development in the poorest parts of that country. Long before economist Jeffrey Sachs or the book Three Cups of Tea made microfinance a household word, these American Christians in Nicaragua were providing funds for small business startups in poverty-stricken communities in Central America. In the fall of 1998, Hurricane Mitch came through Managua, destroying tens of thousands of homes and displacing over 350,000 Nicaraguans. We spent most of our time in Nueva Vida, a tent city outside the capital where thousands of hurricane victims had been relocated by the government in 1998, and Jubilee House Community Partners had set up a medical clinic to serve the needs of these new residents. They were meant to be temporary, and 5 years later, they were still living in those tents. Throughout the 10-day journey, I was moved by the strength, the firm resolve, and the deep faith of the people we met. In a meeting with community leaders, all women, we asked what gave them this sense of hope amid such dire circumstances. One of the women responded for the group with one sentence: "Our community is called Nueva Vida." New life. New life. In the context of that strong, courageous community, I too felt a sense of newness and vitality wash over me. And then after only 10 days, it was time to go home. I was a wreck. On the ride to the airport, I was inconsolable. At the terminal, I dissolved into a 21-year-old pool of tears. I was so sure that the depth of sacred power and the sense of call that I had experienced in Nueva Vida would be lost forever when I landed back in my old life in Raleigh-Durham International Airport and returned for my senior year of college. No matter how long I live, or how many other words crowd my memory, I will never forget those of one of the members of the Jubilee House community as I boarded the plane to return to the United States awash in tears. Grabbing my hand, she said, "Now your work begins." Despite Peter's understandable request, the disciples, like most of us, do not have permanent residence on the mountaintop. We live in a world of carpools and doctor's appointments and flooding basements. We live in a world where hard-working people lose jobs and health care and homes. A world where even the poorest nations can be further devastated by natural disaster, and even those who are far too young can be taken by cruel and inexplicable disease. We can be forgiven for wanting to set up camp when a sacred moment passes our way, because most of the time, our individual and communal lives are not lived in the thin air of high altitude spirituality. So the disciples must do perhaps the most difficult thing any of us are ever called to do. They dust themselves off, and still bleary-eyed from the dazzling vision, they go back home, where there are sick people to be healed, and there are mourners to be comforted, and there are people who have great need, and there is much work to be done. The very next verse in Luke's gospel, after this transfiguration event, the next verse reads, "On the next day, when they had come down from the mountain, a great crowd met them." You see, there is no lingering on the mountain if you want to keep up with Jesus. And so these few moments, these fleeting encounters with the sacred, must provide sustenance for the disciples in the difficult weeks ahead when the mountain of transfiguration will become a hill called Calvary and the booming voice from heaven will be replaced by the jeers and taunts of Roman soldiers. The mountaintop experience will be crucial to their lives as disciples, but only if they go back to the harshness of the real world, and only if they stay awake to holiness in their midst. Moments of doubt and fear will assault them from every side, but if they stay awake, if they remember the words and the images of this mountain, the memory will be enough for them. Enough to carry them to the next divine encounter, early in the morning, on the first day of the week, as the light is just dawning. Transfiguration Sunday stands for us as a reminder that glimpses of holiness we encounter, cloudy and rare as they may be, are gifts from God, meant to be remembered and shared and filed away somewhere for an uncertain future. Thanks to a Netflix subscription, Sarah and I have in recent months had the wonderful opportunity to devote nearly 10 hours of our lives to watching the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I may have been the only person left in America who had not seen any of the movies, but I'm glad I saw them. Of all the interesting and theologically informed storylines that make up Tolkien's plot, the most moving for me is the pilgrimage of the hobbits. Leaving behind the safety and comfort of their homes in the Shire for a journey fraught with risk and danger, a mission on which everything depends. I loved that each time these hobbits are tempted to give up and give in, it is the vision of home that drives them on. Remember the Shire, they say to each other. And this glimpse of a safe and sacred place provides enough hope for another day. As we enter the Lenten season this week, we too should hold fast to the vision that we have been given. With the disciples, we need to hold firmly on to memories of holy encounter in difficult days when we doubt the very presence of God in our lives. The road ahead for us these 40 days, the road leads to Jerusalem, where there will be denial and betrayal and death. There will be the kind of anxious fear that always seems to follow descent from the mountaintop. All this awaits Jesus and his disciples and us. But something important changed on that mountain. Now there is the voice from heaven ringing in our ears. Now there is the confirmation of the law and the prophets and the persons of Moses and Elijah. Now there is that vision of Jesus in dazzling clothes, shining like the sun. A vision you will want to remember on Easter morning, when the women are greeted at an empty tomb by two men. Luke says they were dressed in dazzling white. In those moments when our perspective is clouded and our hope is running thin, when we are immobilized by the pain of this world and our inability to stop it, we can tell one another these stories of vision and holy encounter when the presence of God was just unmistakable. In times heavy with anxiety and distress, the hope they offer may not be much, but it is a glimpse of what is at the heart of it all. It is a promise that all shall be well, and by the grace of God, it is enough to journey on. Amen.